Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f- So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
As counterintuitive as it seems, basically being granted a COVID loan is the single most important factor of an increase in the default of standard loans, non-COVID loans.
I've just opened Google and typed in COVID loans, and now I'm scrolling through the results of the news section. Banks embroiled in row over COVID taxpayer loan guarantee, Sky News. Audi-loving fraudster stole £3 million from firm and government COVID loans, ITV News. COVID loan defaults up 40% among mid-sized firms, Construction Times. Taxpayer hit by Starling's COVID loans, The Times. COVID loans. It's more than I spend on fish a month. Yeah, that last one was from BBC News, and I too was intrigued. It turns out they were speaking to the chef and owner of a restaurant up in Yorkshire whose bounce-back loan repayments are now a big drag on his business. But let's not get too deep into the weeds. My point is just that if the various forms of COVID loans are going to leave a single legacy, it's likely to be one of runaway defaults. I've just looked at the UK government's published figures, and only 76.3% of buyback loan facilities are either fully repaid or are on schedule to be fully repaid. Yeah, not great. And someone should look into why. Well, someone did. Welcome to How to Lend Money to Strangers with Brendan LaGrange. Maurizio Fascetti, a lecturer at Banking and Finance at the University College London. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me today.
Maurizio, one of the things I'm learning at this conference here in Edinburgh is that there's actually a lot more happening in the academic space than I knew of. I think back to the days that I studied, everything finance was much more accounting or sort of merchant investment banking focused, and there wasn't much going on in credit risk. And it seems I've let it slip by me because more and more universities are turning up delivering courses in this world. So maybe we could start there with the University College of London, the work that you're doing there, and more broadly, any thoughts on the academic programs and academic research and kind of what us in the professional side of the business should be paying attention to.
Yeah, thank you. So I am at the University College of London and at the Institute of Finance and Technology. As the name itself says, we are trying to adopt the new quantitative techniques in order to, you know, to grasp a better sense of what is going on in the finance world. We stress a lot financial technology, but we also stress real economic side of finance, with a particular focus on SMEs, because we know that SMEs are like the backbone of an economy.
Yeah, I always love the lending stories for SMEs because they are that pure side of lending where we're helping provide capital to a business that's going to create value.
The way I see that is it's a matter of data. So all the credit scoring practitioners know that it's hard to minimize the financial exclusion of SMEs. So it's a problem. And since it is a complex matter, the university side of it is trying to assess that matter.
Yeah. And, you know, the reason you're here today, or you're here in Edinburgh indeed, is to talk about a topic that I think many of us have read of in the headlines, and maybe we've got some opinions on, but very few of us have informed opinions on. And that's what happened with COVID loans. COVID is still fresh enough in our memories. I think we all remember the chaos of those early days, those first weeks when we were convinced the economy was going to collapse. Governments around the world made funds available in various different forms. And that was good. We needed support to keep businesses going. But obviously, doing things quickly can lead to gaps in systems. And in hindsight, there were mistakes made and money was lost. So I'm really excited to hear your research into who was defaulting on the COVID loans and what you learned by looking at that data. So I'm not going to really structure much of the talk today. I'll just hand it straight over to you. What have you found?
Let me start with the usual disclaimer. Since this is a joint work with many, many extreme valuable people from many institutions, let me say that what I'm discussing today reflects only the personal views of the authors, not necessarily the views of the institutions involved. Now, the COVID loans are a two-sided coin. They have been extremely beneficial, in a way, boosting the profitability of those receiving COVID loans. But also there are some problems in that. Of course, they were supposed to be backup for an extreme event. But for that reason, they needed to be granted in a very timely manner, since most of the loans have been worked through the banking system. Many old customers ended up having the loan. Okay, so there was kind of inertia granting the loan. So not as many new borrowers. And since whenever you've got cheap money in the line, you can register, you can see some adverse selection and moral hazard going on. Okay, so that is also another problem.
The concept of the COVID loans was that some industries were being prevented from doing business. Benefits were for society as a whole by not transmitting the disease, but certain individuals, or certain businesses in this case, were bearing the brunt of the costs, and the money was meant to keep them going until they could operate again. But when it came to who took the loans, did it reflect that certain targeted industries and certain targeted businesses, or was this just a bit of free money to use in normal ongoing operations?
Thank you. This is a really interesting way of looking at our sample. So in our analysis, we were able to see there is an interaction between COVID and non-COVID loans. The defaults in non-COVID-related loans more or less increasing by being granted COVID loans. But that interaction is mediated, if you like, by the size of the firm and also by the characteristic of the firm itself. So think about that. We are in COVID. Most of the small and medium enterprises are in trouble, but the smallest and the most in trouble are the most likely to ask for loans. Once granted the loan, the leverage is inflated, yeah, reflecting the increased riskiness on the non-COVID facilities. Why on the non-COVID facilities? Because the regulation under which COVID loans have been granted are slightly different and are more flexible. And, it's easier to default on standard loans.
Sometimes there's only so much you can do, and there's only so much impact that loans can have on these businesses. But if we talk about it in actual numbers, what are the ratios of the risk? Do you have any numbers in that sense?
I can give you some numbers, but we shouldn't forget that we are relying on a sample. Okay, so we have been lucky enough to be able to access some proprietary data about COVID and non-COVID loans. The sample is quite good. We could look at roughly 500,000 accounts. But again, it's a finite sample. So it's not the overall universe. So other samples might find something slightly different. So we are reasoning in average terms, no? So according to our sample, the default rates on both COVID and non-COVID loans were higher than expected during the pandemic and higher than, the standard numbers that we are used to. So we look at CBILS, the Coronavirus Business Interruption Loan Scheme, and we looked at the BBLS, the Bounce Back Loan Scheme. So these two lending facilities are particularly focused on SMEs. And the difference between the two basically is the size of the firms to which they are intended. CBILS have been granted in numbers of, let's say, 100,000 plus for a worth of 26 billion, whereas the BBLS are more than 1.5 million for 47 billion worth. Is obviously is talking about loans which are quite small, 5,000 to 20,000. The other ones are under 5 million.
It's a valuable pool of data analytics for business loans in general, because COVID was such a wide impact that it's a rare chance to see so many loans less targeted than normal taken at one time.
Yeah, that's a very, very interesting point of view. But also the problem of accessing data is huge in academia as well as for policy matters. So from my personal point of view, we would also need to be a bit more open about policy to share data. But anyway, this is food for thought for another time. Going back to what we did, we looked at the default rates for COVID and non-COVID loans. The default rates literature in academia for practitioners is immense, but the results are not definitive in many ways. So what is driving the default of an SME on a loan? We focused on three potential drivers: the firm's resources, the board level factors, the loan attributes. I don't want to, you know, to bore people going through all the variables that we considered, but we have three categories of variables, and within the categories we have a bunch of other variables. So what we found basically is the following: an increased amount of financial resources, an increased size of the board, and a longer board tenure. All these three elements are decreasing the default rate of firms. This is quite, you know, reasonable, right? Because more financial resources, you have more sound, board tenure, more experience. You can weather the storm a bit better. Size of the board is a bit less intuitive. We are talking about the board size. We're not talking about the firm's size, which plays an extremely important role. And of course, we are measuring the size of the firm. That is another story. What we focused was on the board size, because, you know, corporate governance is important. There is a debate about corporate governance. Many people make it more complex, but that is helping sharing the responsibility. So you make a sounder, maybe a more bulletproof decision.
Yeah, and I think it also speaks to an organization that's big enough and specialized enough that you've got a board where each person has got a role.
Then there is something extremely interesting about the exposure to the foreign experience in the board. Let me just maybe remind all of us a little bit of context. So COVID was something geographically dependent, if you like. I'm Italian. I've been in the UK for the last 10 years. And I remember extremely well where I was, and extremely well that I could see COVID coming, because Italy experienced that first with respect to the UK and other countries.
Yeah, I remember the newspaper stories, and some poor individual was on the front page as patient zero. He had gone skiing in Italy, and he was the one who brought it to the UK. Obviously, in hindsight, it had been, yeah, for 6 months. The poor fellow had his life dragged in the newspaper. But we, at that stage, I think, were naive enough that we had seen it happen in China and said, well, the Chinese authoritarian approach, it's not going to happen here. We saw it in Italy, and then we said, well, it's not going to happen here. And then it was 2 weeks later, and in a matter of hours, suddenly schools were closing, flights were being cancelled, and the thing we didn't expect to happen would happen. More of us should have seen it coming. There were many warning flags, but it did still hit us as a surprise almost.
No, exactly. And that's a beautiful way of laying it down, because firms are not so different from people. So coming back to the study, being exposed to the foreign experience made a huge difference. So just let me give you this as an example. We have two variables, basically, looking at the foreign experience of a firm and how they could drive the overall default rate. One is having a foreign director into the board, so a person who is not UK native. The other one is having a member of the board with a foreign address, so with a structural presence abroad. And interestingly enough, we found that having a foreign director drove the default rate up rather than down. But if that director had a foreign address, that was driving down the default rate. Why? Well, we have been thinking a lot about that, because again, it is quite counterintuitive. But in our view, it has to do with the way the corporate culture is conveyed. So what you need in order to have a beneficial effect of the exposure to a foreign component is a structural presence into a foreign country. So not only has he or she the possibility to understand better and to see it coming, if you like, but also he or she knows both the worlds in a better way. Then the last result, which is also a bit interesting in our view, is about the repayment schedule.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story.
In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
In the banking sector, there's always this debate with looking at what is called market discipline. So we have seen that more flexible repayment schedule is increasing, if you like, the default rate. So if I ask you to repay with a strict frequency, I'm in a way educating you, helping you, guiding you towards a strict financial discipline. And I believe that this, but this is gut feeling, I believe that this is extremely important for SMEs in particular, because, you know, bigger firms tend to have a cash and financial management which is stricter and quite more structured. Whereas here you can really see that even though they are the backbone of our economy, a little bit of financial discipline would definitely help SMEs.
Yeah, I mean, that's really interesting to me. And I wonder whether we know if it's different if the borrower asked for the flexibility versus the lender provided it. But I guess in either case, the borrower chose the flexible route. But we do normally hear the message that, oh, we should be flexible. And a lot of, you know, payment holidays and things, we're introducing some more flexibility in the consumer world. But there is that benefit of discipline that every month I'm making the certain payment does get you to think in a certain way that's longer term and doesn't allow you to just say, well, we'll sort it out in 6 months' time. For now, we're going to have a holiday. And that's, I think, transferable learning in terms of product design. We want the flexibility to react when something happens and goes wrong and our customer needs us to bend for a day or two. We don't want to say the policy says no. But at the same time, we need to be careful that too laissez-faire.
Let me give you also an example. Because, you know, I'm also teaching and interacting with students. Sometimes I've been asked to give explicit deadlines from the students because they help some of them to be more disciplined. Of course, it is not a one-size-fits-all, but it should be an option. Let's put it like that. So maybe self-assessed, maybe not. We can discuss about that, but it should be an option because it definitely helps some firms in this case to be more disciplined.
Again, if we think of the way that COVID loans happened, it's less of a planned out credit acquisition process for a business than a traditional loan would be. It's not that they got to the year end planning and said, well, we need to move in a bigger office or we need to buy a new machine. How much money do we need over what period? What's our income? They were caught as they were. They didn't have time to prepare. And I think that's also where some of these differences come in. You can make a loan flexible because your incomes are flexible. And, you know, the revenue-based lending that happens in the e-commerce world, a new business that's growing fast, yes, we need a different approach. But for a generic business that's out there, it's been operating 4 or 5 years, that discipline may be the best way. If you can do that, it's because you've got the right team in place. You've got the financial discipline. You've got an accountant and a cash flow management system and all that. That's good there. And we shouldn't, when we look at Wayflyer and all the stuff it's doing, think, oh, I must change my traditional bank and do it everything flexible. It is there's downsides to that. And downsides, I think, that are not counterintuitive, but not that you would leap to your mind. You know, I would have sat down with COVID loans and you think, okay, there's going to be some fraud in people impersonating businesses. There's going to be some businesses that are on their way out that are just taking the money and running. I would never have thought of things like this. So I think it's a really interesting nugget to pull out of that.
Yeah, and on that, let me pick up on that, please, because this is one of the caveats of our analysis. We were not able to disentangle exactly what you just mentioned. So fraudulent activities. We know that there have been fraudulent activities in, you know, asking for loans, basically taking the money and running away. So adverse selection as well and moral hazard. Definitely the issue is there, but we are not able to quantify that just yet. We are working a little bit on that.
And of course, the headlines are full of people who took a COVID loan here in the US, around the world, took a COVID loan and bought a Ferrari or something with it. Those cases have happened, but I feel like that probably is a lesser problem than some of the stuff that is quite familiar, again, in the consumer world, a loan that was maybe taken because it was there and maybe underlines this idea of discipline. But somebody who wasn't looking for money, maybe they took it and just thought, well, let's see what we can do with it. Or they thought, well, I don't know what's going to happen in the future. And just in case, I don't know how long I'll have to close, what I'll have to change. And then the money's in the bank. And when the money's in the bank, some people are fine and we carry on as normal. And other people have the money in the bank and they think, well, I want to use this and buy a new building to operate out of. I don't really need it, but the money's there. That's just me making broad sweeping statements. And obviously, in a short interview like this, we really can't cover the nuance, but the beauty of the academic research is that this is research that's published in great detail and available to read in great detail. So if anybody listening would like to have a look at that, where can they find the research? Where can they maybe reach out to speak to you and learn about what it's showing?
Yeah, well, so at the moment, we don't have a working paper because we're in the process of submitting for publication and doing a little bit more work on this and submitting for publication. But obviously, I mean, I'm always there. I mean, I'm a public profile, so everybody can reach me out and I'll be extremely happy to engage. I should have mentioned maybe before, but there's also a publicly funded research from UKRI. And we really do care about giving back to the public. So whoever wants to know more or be engaged with this research is totally welcome.
Great. Yeah. And I'll put the links to your profile in the show notes. I think we'll keep an eye on the research and let everyone know when it's published as well. We were all impacted by COVID. We all have some interest in COVID loans. You point out it's our money. So there's lots of reasons to follow it. But I think anybody who's just in the SME lending world would also do well to have a look at what you found. Well, yeah, Maurizio, thank you so much for your time. I'm going to be reading the abstract, having a look at that as it comes out from my side. Thank you very much for joining me. And yeah, I hope to stay in touch.
My pleasure. And thank you for having me.
And thank you all for listening. Please do look for and follow the show on your favorite podcast platform and share the updates widely on LinkedIn. Plus, send me a connection request while you're there. This show is written and recorded by myself, Brendan LaGrange, in Brighton, England. Show music is by I Am Wake, and you can find show notes and written transcripts at www.howtolendmoneytostrangers.show. And I'll see you again next Thursday.
When we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.